Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, February 16th, 2026. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Two University of Idaho economists estimate there will be a $5.1 billion reduction in Idaho productivity in three key industries if immigration agents remove a significant portion of Idaho's undocumented workers. University of Idaho to start partnering with the University of Utah for physician teaching. Saturday town hall at the 1912 Center attracts about 100 concerned about the legislature's plans to cut Medicaid and Medicare funding. District 6 Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston talks about legislative priorities at Coffee with the Legislators event at the Moscow Chamber of Commerce. And the Pullman Vigil for Sanity coverage. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report, but first, world headlines from Feature Story News, the Pacifica Radio Network, and the Public News Service.
U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has outlined the difficulties in negotiating with Iran, but says he's hopeful the two nations can reach an agreement in the coming days. Officials are due to meet next in Geneva on Tuesday local time, as the U.S. demands that Iran winds down any nuclear ambitions, threatening military action if it does not. Speaking during a visit to Hungary, Secretary Rubio said any agreement will not come easily.
I mean, we have to understand that Iran ultimately is governed and its decisions are governed by Shia clerics, radical Shia clerics, okay? These people make policy decisions on the basis of pure theology. That's how they make their decisions. So it's hard to do a deal with Iran. We've always said it's hard, but we're going to try.
Iran's top diplomat held talks with UN nuclear watchdog in Geneva a day before the second round of negotiations between the U.S. and Iran. Iran's foreign minister Abbas Araghchi met with IAEA chief Rafael Grossi. Oman is hosting the U.S.-Iran talks in Geneva on Tuesday. After U.S. President Donald Trump ordered an additional aircraft carrier to the region, Iran today and launched a second naval drill in weeks. Sailors passing through the region reportedly received by radio a warning that the northern lane of the Strait of Hormuz and Iranian territorial waters likely would see a live fire drill. Over the weekend, Senator Lindsey Graham spoke at the 62nd Munich Security Conference during a demonstration for human rights in Iran.
If we back out now, it'd be the biggest mistake we've made, far worse than the Syrian red line, far worse than Afghanistan. You can't say, keep protesting, we got you back, help's on the way, and nothing happened. That's why I am confident that President Trump will get an outcome consistent with those three statements through diplomacy or military force.
Sanez is an American cafe owner in Berkeley who came to the Bay Area 13 years ago. Sanez is raising her two children in the East Bay, but still has family, including her brother, in Iran. She says the people of Iran need real support from the United Nations, and that right now, they feel desperate.
They are very helpless. They are being shut down. They are being silenced, and they need help. And it's very surprising for us that the world is silenced. It's like Iranian regime says that they are 3,000 people being killed, and media says like 30,000 to 50,000, which 30,000 by itself, it's a lot of people. And we don't see any like help and support from other, like from, it's not relatively a lot of support, just saying that you're sorry about that.
When asked if she thinks the U.S. or Israel have the best interests of Iran or Iranians at heart, Sanez said, absolutely not.
Of course, no, I don't think so. I think it's something about Iranian people being tired of their regime. They deserve more. They deserve better life. It's nothing to do with America or Israel or anywhere else. It's just about them want to live a better life.
Sanez says the people of Iran are best suited to decide what is in their best interests, and she hopes the world will hear their voices.
The European Union says it will send an observer to President Trump's Board of Peace meeting in Washington on Thursday. The bloc was invited to be a full member of the initiative, but declined to join. Ross Callan reports.
The EU Commissioner for the Mediterranean, the Croatian politician Dubravka Switzer, will represent Brussels in the US capital later this week for the first formal meeting of US President Donald Trump's Board of Peace. An EU spokesperson said that the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen was invited to the Thursday meeting but will not participate. The Board of Peace is designed to oversee Gaza's reconstruction, but the EU has what it says are a number of questions about elements of the board's setup, including its governance and its compatibility with the United Nations Charter. But though the EU as a whole will not be officially joining the Donald Trump-chaired initiative, two EU member states, Hungary and Bulgaria, participated in a formal signing ceremony last month.
President Donald Trump said that members of his newly created Board of Peace have pledged $5 billion toward rebuilding Gaza and will commit thousands of personnel to international stabilization and police forces for the territory. Trump said Sunday that the pledges will be formally announced when members of the board gather for their first meeting Thursday in Washington. Indonesia's military says up to 8,000 of its troops are expected to be ready by the end of June for a potential deployment to Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli forces killed at least 11 Palestinians in attacks across the Gaza Strip on Sunday. The Israeli killings mark the latest violation of a U.S. brokered ceasefire that came into effect on October 10th. Munthir Abu Rabia is a displaced Palestinian who's been moving from place to place with his wife and young children since October of 2023. Rabia says in spite of the so-called ceasefire and the formation of the Board of Peace, people in Gaza still yearn for peace and a reprieve.
They mentioned that we have a ceasefire, and that is in the news only. Even we have a ceasefire, they bomb houses, they kill children, they kill women, and they pretend that they are working in the military.
I asked Rabia about the Rafah border crossing.
Actually, on the media, it's open, but in reality, it is not, because they just allow only 5 people, sometimes 20 people, or 20 patients to leave Gaza. Even the people who need to travel outside Gaza for treatment, more than 20,000. So does it make any sense?
As for food, Rabia says it's ample at the moment, but the problem is people don't have money to buy it.
The food that coming to Gaza, it is for merchant, is not for free. In Gaza, 90% of Gaza people, they don't have any source of income. Even we have a food in Gaza, but we don't have money to buy this food. So that make the situation more miserable and more complicated.
And with Ramadan just days away, Rabia says there's much to worry about.
Normally in Ramadan month, we will have a new conflict, a new fight every single year. So hopefully this year we will not have any war and no one will be killed in Gaza.
India is hosting the AI summit in New Delhi this week, the first time the event's been held in the global south. CEOs from top tech firms will be in attendance, many hoping to make inroads in the world's most populous country. Ishan Gurg reports.
Indian officials say the AI Impact Summit will showcase real-world application of AI in areas such as agriculture, education and payments. While previous iterations of the summit have focused on ensuring guardrails around AI, India says it wants to push democratization of the technology. Officials say the host country is hoping to focus on conversations around the central theme of people, planet and progress. The event will also see at least 3 Indian firms launch indigenously developed large language models to rival services like ChatGPT. Analysts say India is hoping to pitch itself as the country best placed to provide the talent workforce for the AI revolution, as well as the largest market for AI products.
5 European countries that said that Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny was poisoned by Moscow with a rare and lethal toxin found in the skin of poisonous dart frogs. The foreign ministries of France, the UK, Germany, Sweden, and the Netherlands said that analysis in European labs of samples taken from Navalny's body conclusively confirmed the presence of epididymine. They said that the neurotoxin secreted by dart frogs in South Africa is not found naturally in Russia. In a joint statement, they said that Russia had the means, motive, and opportunity to administer the poison. The 5 European countries said they were reporting the Russian Federation to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons for a breach of the Chemical Weapons Convention. Navalny was a fierce foe of Russian President Vladimir Putin, who died in an Arctic penal colony in February of 2024 while serving a 19-year sentence that he believed to be politically motivated.
The UK government has promised to move more quickly to close loopholes in laws designed to protect children online. Prime Minister Keir Starmer says no platform will get a free pass on children's safety and has vowed to crack down on the addictive elements of social media. The UK's Online Safety Act was drafted before the emergence of AI chatbots, which have been criticised for giving children misleading information or even harmful suggestions on everything from mental health advice to eating habits. Rowan Ferguson from the Molly Rose Foundation believes the legislation needs strengthening.
The Online Safety Act is a landmark piece of legislation, and it remains an excellent foundation for protecting our children. But unfortunately, it's just not working as intended. And the measures that we have are really baking in that sort of a status quo rather than stretching platforms to go further to protect kids.
North London is going through a significant measles outbreak, the UK Health Security Agency has confirmed. It's mostly passing between primary and nursery school children under the age of 10, and it has led to hospitalisations among unvaccinated children. Stuart Smith reports.
Over 60 children have contracted measles in the borough of Enfield in North London, according to the latest official data, with the UK capital accounting for nearly two-thirds of all cases in England. It's a highly infectious and sometimes deadly disease with no cure, but it's easily prevented with two doses of a free vaccine. The regional chief medical officer says there's no single cause for a lack of vaccine uptake, which across London averages around 65%, far lower than the 95% rate among under-fives to prevent transmission. Vaccine scepticism, access to information and practical barriers to arranging appointments are all factors contributing to low uptake, according to officials.
UK police are facing growing pressure to open a full criminal investigation into Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's time as UK trade envoy. It comes after released documents appear to show him sharing sensitive information with the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Thames Valley Police confirmed last week it's assessing claims following the latest release of Epstein files. Legal commentator Joshua Rosenberg says police are currently deciding whether to open a full investigation.
You have to be a public officer acting in that role who willfully neglects to perform his duty or willfully misconducts himself to such a degree as to amount to an abuse of the public's trust in the office holder and without reasonable excuse or justification. In other words, the question is whether Andrew Mountbatten Windsor willfully misconducted himself as a trade envoy to such a degree as to amount to an abuse of the public's trust.
Naveed Akram, one of the men accused of killing 15 people in a mass shooting at a Jewish festival on Sydney's Bondi Beach, has appeared in court for the first time since his release from the hospital. Akram did not enter pleas to the charges against him, including murder and committing a terrorist act. Today's court appearance focused on extending a gag order that suppresses the identities of victims and survivors of the attack who have not chosen to identify themselves publicly. Defense lawyer Ben Archbold told reporters that it was too early to indicate any intentions of pleas. Akram was wounded and his father, Sajid Akram, was killed in a gun battle with police after the shooting in December.
Some Massachusetts families are struggling to pay the high cost of tariffs imposed on essential and often legally required baby products. Price data show items like strollers, cribs, and car seats have jumped nearly 25% since the Trump administration imposed new fees on Chinese manufactured goods last spring. Kenzie Kinsella with the Western Mass nonprofit It Takes a Village says more parents are asking for help, but donations are on the decline.
Our wait list right now for a proper 5-point harness car seat, I mean, we have 10 or 11 families waiting, and that's with us trying, you know, our very best to make connections.
She says requests for baby formula, diapers, and even children's winter gear have also increased. The Trump administration says higher tariffs on Chinese-made goods are needed for national security and that it will consider exemptions for baby products. It Takes a Village serves the four counties of Western Massachusetts, but families often drive from out of state seeking help. What began as a small donation project out of a Huntington basement in 2009 has grown into a 6,000-square-foot facility, offering workforce training, parenting skills classes, a community food cupboard, and more. Kinsella says they recently changed their hours to better support the many working parents who struggle to make ends meet.
Families are working so hard to support their children, so having a place to turn to, like the Village Closet, where there is no judgment, that they can come and we can try our very best to support them in what they are looking for can be a huge weight off their shoulders.
She says more than 70 volunteers hand sort all donations to ensure items are in good condition and that it isn't uncommon for up to 200 individuals to shop during open hours. She notes transportation can be a barrier for many families to get to the center and says volunteers will deliver items to families when needed. More than 500 deliveries were made last year.
More than 1,000 immigration agents have left Minnesota, and hundreds more will be departing in the days to come. This is part of the Trump administration's drawdown of its immigration enforcement surge. That word comes from the White House border czar, Tom Homan. On CBS's Face the Nation, Homan said that a small security force will remain for a short period to protect remaining immigration agents from what he called agitators. Meanwhile, immigrant communities across the country remain tense and afraid. This Valentine's Day weekend, immigrant rights advocates took to the streets to spread love in communities that are both afraid and vulnerable. KPFA's David Rosenberg has more.
The Concord Immigrant Protection Network, along with local organizations, residents, and elected officials, led a Love Your Neighbor Valentine's Day procession through the city's Monument neighborhood to show love, solidarity, and protection for immigrant neighbors in the midst of escalating fears around ICE enforcement. Betty Gabaldon is with the Concord Immigrant Protection Network.
We have seen, you know, a lot of people at the court, immigration court, you know, getting kidnapped and disappeared. And of course, you know, people around that area are very scared. We did a survey in a community, the most impacted community here in Concord, and, you know, there's so much fear right now. People wanted to, like, going to work, but, you know, scared of going to work. A lot of mental health issues.
And that's David Rosenberg reporting.
It won't completely stop detentions of local immigrants by ICE agents, but recent legislation passed in New Mexico sets a precedent in efforts to protect them. The Immigrant Safety Act ends existing ICE detention contracts in the state and prevents the use of state resources for federal immigration enforcement. It also stops the use of public land for immigration detention. Attorney Carla Law with the ACLU of New Mexico says such measures have been a priority for her group for several years, but are needed now more than ever to combat the Trump administration's massive detention efforts.
We're aware that if one minority group or if one marginalized community is on the chopping block, it's just a matter of time until another community that has been marginalized will be up for discrimination.
The ACLU notes that at least 8 people already have died through interactions with ICE in 2026. The state's Immigrant Safety Act will take effect on May 20th. It passed the legislature with a vote of 24-15 and was signed by the governor. A study by researchers at UCLA shows the new Trump administration enforcement tactics have led to an increase in street arrests in communities by a factor of 11. Law says the new Immigrant Safety Act ends the federal 287G provision in New Mexico, withdrawing the state from a program that trains local police to assist immigration agencies and instead keeps them focused on local crime.
With the prohibition of these types of agreements on a state level, we're really ensuring public safety is higher than ever amongst our most vulnerable communities and that they feel safe enough to approach local law enforcement without fear of them acting as deportation agents.
ICE has contracts with 3 New Mexico detention centers, and opponents of the Safety Act said it could harm the economies of rural counties where they're located. But advocates of the bill argued there are documented cases in all 3 of abuses and untimely deaths. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
West Virginia lawmakers are considering a bill that would require bystanders remain at least 30 feet away from police officers, firefighters, and EMS engaged in their duties. Critics say the law is aimed at chipping away at residents' constitutional right to record the actions of law enforcement. The proposed legislation comes on the heels of high-profile bystander videos of immigration and customs enforcement officers that captured the deaths of 2 citizens in Minneapolis, according to Rusty Williams with the ACLU of West Virginia.
The George Floyd murder, that footage was recorded at about 10 feet. The footage that we saw just recently of the situation in Minneapolis with Alex Pretty, that footage was filmed between 15 and 20 feet.
As currently written, violating the 30-foot rule or engaging in behavior that could be interpreted as menacing would result in fines and possible jail time. The legislation now sits with the House for consideration. Supporters say the bill is designed to protect first responders, often working under high-stress conditions, from harassment and distractions. Williams sees the bill as a distraction. He believes lawmakers aren't putting enough effort into trying to solve problems related to housing affordability, jobs, healthcare, and education.
When the legislature came out before session and said that they were going to focus on economic and infrastructure issues, we were hoping that they would stick to that.
Lawmakers also are considering another piece of legislation that would mandate local and state law enforcement agencies cooperate with ICE agents. This is Nadia Romlagan for West Virginia News Service.
The NAACP and allied groups are asking a judge to limit how the federal government uses voter data seized in an FBI raid near Atlanta. In a motion filed late Sunday, they asked the judge to bar any use beyond the stated criminal investigation. They also asked for a full inventory of what agents took during the January 28th seizure at the Fulton County Elections Hub and who has access to it. FBI agents arrived at the elections warehouse with a warrant seeking 2020 Fulton County elections records. The Justice Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment today.
The Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or SAVE Act, is now before the U.S. Senate. After narrowly passing the House in April of last year, the bill would require in-person proof of citizenship to register to vote. Voting rights advocates call it unnecessary and discriminatory, warning it would end online and mail registration and disenfranchise millions of eligible voters. Michigan Congresswoman Haley Stevens opposes the proposal and says she'll push to restore the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which requires federal review of election law changes in places with a history of discrimination.
To protect every American's right to vote in this country and to pass the Freedom to Vote Act. And this is going to ensure that every American can have their voice heard and their vote counted.
Supporters of the SAVE Act argue the measure is needed to protect election integrity, saying requiring in-person proof of citizenship would help prevent non-citizens from registering to vote and restore public confidence in U.S. elections. Brian Limick, executive director of Defend the Vote, says the requirement to present a passport or birth certificate could hit Michiganders especially hard.
60% of Michigan residents, they don't have a passport. That's like 5 or 6 million people. And more than 2 million women in Michigan don't have a birth certificate that matches their married name, so they wouldn't be eligible to vote. So just across the country, we're going to see tens of millions of people that don't have the documents required.
Backers of the SAVE Act contend the bill sets a clear, uniform national standard, making voter registration more transparent and easier to verify. From Michigan News Connection, I'm Crystal Blair.
The nonprofit organization Protect Our Care condemned the comments of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for what he said in a podcast with comedian Theo Vaughn.
I'm not scared of a germ. You know, I used to snort cocaine off of toilet seats.
The organization statement said that RFK Jr. continues to lay bare why he is the most dangerous, in over his head, ill-suited person ever to lead such an important federal agency that has life and death power.
KRFP, Moscow.
Healthcare officials say a new level 4 EMS trauma facility on the Winnebago Nation will mean faster and more efficient care for residents who need emergency medical attention, marking an improvement over the current model. Winnebago Comprehensive Healthcare Services completed a $15 million emergency department in December, which then received a level 4 trauma center designation from the Nebraska Department of Public Health. Marketing specialist Hallie Murray says the new facility is a dramatic upgrade over calling 911.
Maybe the response time for Winnebago is longer if you try to call 911. So here we actually have our own emergency line. It's just a quicker response time, whether that's just needing help with something, you know, a ride to the hospital in an ambulance.
It took 6 years for Winnebago's emergency department to earn the trauma center designation, which included rigorous training for the medical professionals and other staff who work there. In addition to advanced training and updated treatment protocols, the site itself was subject to a series of inspections and reviews prior to its Level 4 designation. Murray says the trauma center fills a big need on the Winnebago Nation.
There's always people who need help here on the reservation. Again, just getting to them quicker and helping them out the best that we can and helping them get the care that they deserve. And I would say, it's a huge need in the Winnebago community right now.
Nebraska has one Level 1 trauma center located in Omaha. I'm Mark Moran for Nebraska News Connection.
The Council on American Islamic Relations released the 2025 Hostile Campus Ratings Report. The report evaluated 51 campuses, including the University of California, San Francisco, that have engaged in the suppression and targeting of Muslim, Palestinian, Arab, and allied students speaking out against genocide from October 2023 to December of 2025. 12 campuses adopted controversial IHRA anti-Semitism definitions, which critics say legitimizes the Israeli genocide. Here's Bisma Jeffers, a civil rights attorney.
You're not allowed to critique Israel's policies. Is it going to expand to other countries? Is the definition of anti-Semitism going to continue to expand as well, where you can't even say that you're Muslim or you're Palestinian without being called anti-Semitic? It also silences the voices of our Jewish allies, too, and the Jewish Palestinians and the neighbors of Israel, that they see what America is doing and maybe they want to follow.
Jeffers worries about the long-term implications on First Amendment rights.
Critiquing government is part of our First Amendment rights, and this is foreign government, so to have such a heavy hand in policing critiques of it, it doesn't speak to our amendments, it doesn't speak to our constitutional rights. You know, it is a violation.
Jeffers says that while many of the results look grim for Muslim Americans in looking at overall Islamophobia trends, she says even releasing the data is an important first step.
The Black Panther Museum is hosting the 1-800 Happy Birthday exhibit in honor of the late Oscar Grant III, who would turn 40 this month if he was alive. Grant was killed by former BART police officer Johannes Messerly on New Year's Day in 2009.
My name is Mohammed Borghestani. I'm the artist behind 1-800 Happy Birthday.
1-800 Happy Birthday is an exhibition honoring Black and Brown lives that have been cut short by police violence. Originally, it was a voicemail project that has transformed into a large-scale exhibition, a portion of which is now on display at the Black Panther Museum in Oakland. Gorgestani, the lead artist of the project, says it's only possible because of community and collaboration.
This is about community, and this is about taking something that was a tragic and horrific event that shouldn't have happened to anyone and reclaiming it and creating a platform built out of the grief for people to congregate, inspire each other, and feel love for someone that has inspired a whole generation to resist state oppression, police violence, and white supremacy.
An Ohio environmental group and a Northeast Ohio legal expert say the Environmental Protection Agency's repeal of the federal endangerment finding could reshape how air pollution is regulated, with consequences reaching local communities. The EPA announced it is rescinding the 2009 finding that greenhouse gases endanger public health, a determination that has underpinned federal climate regulations for more than a decade. Joe Florida, executive director of Power a Clean Future Ohio, says the move shifts responsibility and potential costs closer to home.
The Environmental Protection Agency ruled that they no longer have the authority to regulate harmful air pollution that is driving climate change. And the scale of this decision is incredibly detrimental to the future of our planet, to the well-being of our communities, to the safety of children, to our own health.
EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin has argued the Clean Air Act does not authorize regulation of greenhouse gases, and the repeal is expected to face legal challenges in federal court. Miranda Lepla, director of the Environmental Law Clinic at Case Western Reserve University School of Law, says the endangerment finding stems from a 2007 U.S. Supreme Court ruling surrounding the Clean Air Act.
The purpose of the Clean Air Act is to protect the health of the public. That is the gist of what the Clean Air Act does, and they do that by regulating dangerous pollutants that pose a risk to our public health and to everyone's health in every corner of the United States.
Environmental advocates say Ohio's local governments are already preparing for rising infrastructure and public health costs linked to extreme weather. Supporters of the rollback argue it restores limits on federal authority. Legal challenges could determine how future administrations can regulate climate pollution under the Clean Air Act. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
South Dakotans steeped in environmental work aren't holding back their frustrations since the Trump administration has formally revoked a key protection to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Last week, the Environmental Protection Agency finalized its repeal of what is known as the endangerment finding, which advocates say has long served as the legal backbone for climate regulations under the Clean Air Act. It arose from scientific evidence that carbon dioxide, methane, and other emissions endanger public health. Suzanne Skirm is with the Sierra Club South Dakota chapter, and with the state being a top wind energy producer, she's more worried about the repeal eventually harming water quality.
There are so many
rivers and streams and lakes that are impaired. And if there's no impetus to clean those streams up, they're only going to get dirtier.
Researchers say with looser regulations of greenhouse gas emissions linked to climate change, there will be more indirect strains on water infrastructure through increased flooding and drought. Environmental partners say they're exploring legal options. The EPA says it's the single largest deregulatory action in U.S. history, touting benefits to the automotive industry. As for air quality, Skirm worries South Dakota will notice the effects from just beyond its borders.
If our neighboring states keep using fossil fuels, that's going to impact us, of course. The pollution gets blown in here.
North Dakota and Wyoming are neighboring states that consistently rank among the higher fossil fuel producers. The Sierra Club says while this rule change specifically concerns greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles, the current EPA has made it clear it also won't prioritize curbing other sources of climate pollution, like power plants. This is Mike Moen for Greater Dakota News Service.
The Sierra Club Arkansas chapter is among the environmental groups saying they will file lawsuits to stop the Trump administration from repealing what's known as the endangerment finding. The ruling passed in 2009 determined six greenhouse gases are dangerous to public health and the environment and that the EPA can regulate them under the Clean Air Act. Sierra Club attorney Tony Mendoza says despite the proposed changes, they will continue to fight for environmental justice in the natural state.
In Arkansas, we're focused on removing obstacles to bring online clean energy, which ultimately will replace the energy that the coal plants produce. We're focused on holding the polluters accountable to the regulations that are on the books.
President Donald Trump has said the endangerment finding has no basis in fact or law and drove up prices for consumers. Last year, the White Bluff coal plant near Little Rock and the Plum Point plant in northeast Arkansas were among 68 coal plants granted a two-year extension to comply with new clean energy standards. Mendoza says the decision will result in more Arkansans ingesting mercury from breathing polluted air, eating contaminated fish from lakes near power plants, and swimming in polluted bodies of water.
What we're seeing from the Trump administration is they're trying to roll back to a time before those requirements existed. And so it'll impact people across the board, more asthma attacks, more respiratory illness, more heart attacks.
Over the years, federal courts have repeatedly rejected legal challenges to the finding, including a 2023 decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. I'm Frieda Ross, Arkansas News Service.
An Environmental Protection Agency finding outlining the harms of greenhouse gas emissions has been revoked by the Trump administration. Climate advocates say the repeal of the 2009 endangerment finding paves the way for unregulated pollution. Kentucky Chapter Director for Sierra Club Julia Finch says revoking the federal assessment on greenhouse gases doesn't make the impacts of air pollution or climate change disappear, and it doesn't prevent industries from polluting. She says the decision just shifts the burden onto families and communities.
We know Kentuckians face higher asthma rates, higher lung issues than a lot of other places in the country. And so we really feel that we will see this impact not only in a kind of financial impact or an economic impact, but certainly in a health impact as well.
Supporters of the decision, including EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin, say the rollback will reduce economic uncertainty and help industries reduce costs associated with environmental compliance. But Finch says many industries see a future in clean energy and are searching for states where that future is possible. She notes the Commonwealth recently lost out on a green aluminum smelter to Oklahoma, which supplies 40% of its energy from renewables. Kentucky is still 70% reliant on coal and falling out of step with evolving industries that are cleaning themselves up.
And this is what this green aluminum smelter project was going to do, and it was also going to make Americans competitive again on this aluminum global market. And we had a huge opportunity in Kentucky.
According to the Environmental Defense Fund, businesses will face more chaos, instability, and potential losses as a result of the EPA endangerment finding rollback. This is Nadia Romlagan for Kentucky News Connection.
Members of a California faith organization are speaking out against the Environmental Protection Agency's decision to reverse the rule that underpins climate protections under the Clean Air Act. The EPA finalized a decision reversing the 2009 endangerment finding, a legal provision that says greenhouse gases put human health at risk and therefore must be regulated. Susan Stevenson with the nonprofit California Interfaith Power and Light says the EPA is betraying its own mission.
Their mission is to protect human health and the environment, And this claim that global warming is not a threat is unfathomable, and it is a morally reprehensible act.
To accompany the rollback of the rule, the EPA is planning a massive deregulation of federal emissions standards for cars and trucks. The president has argued that anti-pollution measures stymie industry and add to the cost of a vehicle. California Attorney General Rob Bonta has vowed to sue to stop the new EPA rule, as have a number of environmental groups. But if this change stands, dozens of environmental regulations could be struck down. Stevenson says Americans must continue to reduce their reliance on fossil fuels, regardless.
We have thousands of religious institutions around the state and around the country that are greening their facilities, reducing their carbon footprints, planting trees, working to make their communities healthier and make our climate more sustainable.
California Interfaith Power and Light submitted nearly 5,000 comments by people of faith in opposition to the new EPA rule during the public comment period. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A new technology could help keep electric vehicles, which can tap twice as much energy as an entire household, from stressing already challenged power grids. Instead of charging an EV at times of peak demand when people get home from work, an algorithm waits until later in the night when rates drop. Active managed charging programs also make sure that batteries are fully charged before drivers leave for work in the morning. Data scientist Frederick Hall with Energy Hub says it allows participating drivers to lower their energy bills without managing charging times on their own.
By shifting energy into the off-peak period, the cost of charging reduced by 50%. And so that's, you know, significant savings for folks to basically cut their charging costs in half.
A new report finds an active managed charging program in Washington State saved EV users up to $400 each year, and vehicles were always fully charged in the morning. The typical driver commutes 30 miles a day, which requires about 2 hours of charging each night. Hall says by actively managing many cars across multiple neighborhoods, the system can more evenly distribute demand throughout the night. Utilities also benefit when EVs aren't adding to a spike in energy use in the early evenings, when people start flipping switches, doing laundry, cooking dinner, and watching TV. Hall says active managed charging can bring utility companies more customers spread out during the day. Ratepayers can also benefit because redistributed demand allows utilities to delay costly upgrades.
We're able to achieve a 2x increase in hosting capacity, and so that means that utilities are able to add on twice as many electric vehicles before they're needing to upgrade certain distribution assets on their local distribution grid.
More EV models now feature vehicle-to-grid capabilities. This allows a utility to call on EVs sitting in garages as a vast network of backup power, creating what some call a virtual power plant. When demand surges, those vehicles can send power to the grid for others to use or just power the house they're sitting in. This story was produced with original reporting from Matt Simon for Grist. This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
Environmental groups in Georgia are speaking out after the Trump administration finalized its repeal of the Environmental Protection Agency's endangerment finding. The 2009 provision has served as the scientific and legal basis for regulating climate pollution under the Clean Air Act. Michael Hawthorne Jr. with the Sierra Club says the decision could have significant consequences for communities across the state.
Unfortunately, it really just sets the precedent that even with how we look at our emissions from our cars and a lot of utilities, it really gives them the opportunity to just essentially pollute without any sense of responsibility.
The endangerment finding requires the EPA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from major sources such as vehicles and power plants. Supporters of the repeal argue the change will ease regulatory burdens and provide relief to industries such as automobile manufacturing. Hawthorne says in Georgia, the decision comes as utilities weigh long-term investments in fossil fuel infrastructure. He says the broader concern is how those policy shifts could affect environmental and climate conditions in the region.
What we are seeing, continuous impactful storms that are becoming more intense because of these greenhouse gases.
Sierra Club leaders say they are exploring legal options in response to the repeal. For Georgia News Connection, I'm Shantia Hudson.
New York state lawmakers are advancing efforts to regulate forever chemicals in the state. Along with a bill enacting a moratorium on using biosolids as farm fertilizer, the legislature is considering several bills to remove PFAS from various consumer products. These include beauty products, dental floss, and other household items. Kate Donovan with the Natural Resources Defense Council explains the chemicals became common because, despite their health impacts, they were sold as a consumer convenience.
The manufacturers of these chemicals, DuPont and 3M, they knew for a very long time that these were dangerous
toxic chemicals, but never reported it and kept it secret. It would allow these chemicals to continue to be produced for decades and to be put into the marketplace without a lot of knowledge about its health concerns.
The health impacts range from increased risk of certain cancers to developmental effects in children. Donovan says some of the most significant opposition is from non-stick cookware companies who argue the Teflon they use is safe, though data shows otherwise. While the state Senate passed two bills regarding PFAS this month, Donovan notes getting them through the assembly is a challenge. New York passed legislation to ban PFAS in clothing, firefighting foam, and food packaging in the last few years, but some companies are voluntarily removing these chemicals from their products. Donovan says reports show the state will pay high health care costs from PFAS at a time when money is dwindling.
A conservative estimate was between $2.7 and $4.4 billion annually the state is expected to spend on health care related to PFAS contamination.
Other reports show half of all the state's water systems have some level of PFAS, with more than 250 local waterways exceeding state-regulated levels of forever chemicals. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
From Feature Story News in New York, I'm Mitch McCann.
In the UK, I'm John Beaver.
I'm Sharon Sabota.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Researchers from the University of Idaho presented their report on the economic impact of deportations in the state at the state capitol building in Boise Friday, and said deporting a significant portion of Idaho's undocumented workforce may reduce the workforce in three major industries by nearly 27,000 workers and cause a domino effect in the supply chain, resulting in a total loss of about 56,000 jobs. The Idaho Alliance for a Legal Workforce funded the study, which University of Idaho professors Timothy Nadreau and Stephen Peterson conducted with the help of Washington State University professors. They estimate Idaho has 40,000 undocumented workers. Trump deportation head Stephen Miller wants his immigration agents to arrest 3,000 people per day nationwide, although the Trump administration is claiming they want to deport the worst of the worst criminals. Department of Homeland Security data shows only 15% of those detained or deported have been convicted of violent crimes. Nadreau and Peterson estimated the job losses for three industries that have the largest undocumented workforces, agriculture, construction, and hospitality, account for nearly a third of Idaho's economy. The Idaho Capital Sun reported Nadreau spoke of the estimated loss of Idaho jobs, saying the 56,000 jobs that we're talking about would be like extracting Twin Falls County from Idaho. This is explicitly taking a shot across the bow of our growth industries for the state. And this comes at a time when our economy is sitting on a knife's edge. One of the scenarios the researchers used was the removal of 50% of the undocumented workers in each of the three industries they studied. Under that scenario, the state would lose 45% of the dairy industry's productivity, 22.5% of its agricultural productivity, and 10% of its hospitality productivity. That loss of productivity is equivalent to $5.1 billion, which would mean a loss of $397.8 million in state tax revenue. Nadreau said the productivity losses will cause waves that will impact other industries that use agricultural and dairy products, noting that Twin Falls-based yogurt maker Chobani has a plant in Twin Falls that employs more than 1,000 people and depends on the state's milk supply. A group of far-right Idaho legislators announced earlier this month they will move to introduce a series of bills targeting immigrants that they wrote with the help of former Trump administration deputy assistant and former Idaho Solicitor General Theo Wold. Republican Senator Brian Lenny of Nampa worked with Wold, who started as a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation in July of last year, to craft a law creating a new state crime for organizations who conceal, harbor, or shield people in the country without documentation, who are often the targets of ICE's new slew of terror campaigns against citizens and non-citizens alike. Other planned bills would require Idaho employers to use the immigration status checking software E-Verify, require financial information and audits from the private nonprofit Office for Refugees, and requiring local governments to track the number of undocumented inmates in jails and prisons and the number of undocumented students in public schools. One bill would require local law enforcement to enter into 287G agreements with ICE, even though those agreements worsen police discrimination and increase the risk of arrest, detention, and deportation of immigrants living in or traveling in places that participate in the 287G program. Lawmakers have introduced some of the bills in committee this year, but so far there have been no hearings on them. Senator Lenny claimed, while announcing the bills, that they would address the human rights issue of legal and illegal immigration. He said, "It's time to say no more cheap slave labor, no more propping up the third world, no more subsidizing corporate greed, cartels, and modern-day slavers through the exploitation of tens of thousands of foreign nationals who are currently in Idaho as we're sitting here." Idaho Dairymen's Association CEO Rick Narabout said he took offense. Narabout said, "That is a comment that comes from a place of ignorance. My dairymen are good people. They treat their workers well." Steve Martinez of the Idaho Home Builders Association told the Idaho Press proposals in the Idaho legislature are knee-jerk reactions and would only add more layers to the problem. Martinez said, "I believe the federal government caused this, and I feel like it's their job to fix this." Narabout had a comment about legislative proposals. He said, "Sadly, there are policies that have been introduced in this legislature that would be counterproductive to President Trump's vision for Idaho and for America. As this report outlines, policies that destabilize the existing workforce would cost Idaho. Those are unacceptable consequences to satisfy simply a political narrative." Tommy Alquist, a major Treasure Valley real estate developer, said he opposes the bill requiring E-Verify because it would add more red tape and complicate bureaucracy. Alquist said, "We need to try to help the industries that we're talking about today get through this crisis until we can have solutions at the federal level to fix these problems. For our industry, for housing, for workers that really are driving our economy." Martinez says the Idaho Home Builders Association estimates one-third of the state's construction workforce is foreign-born, and there would be slower construction without them. He said so far, Trump's immigration raids on construction sites have been less than expected. Martinez said it didn't end up being the boogeyman that all thought it would be, but then again, time will tell.
Organic farmers in Idaho are holding a conference this week to tout the benefits of a natural approach to agriculture. After a five-year hiatus, the Growers' Own Organic Farming Conference is back and meeting in Caldwell on Saturday. Tim Summer is a veteran organic farmer in Idaho and one of the keynote speakers for this year's conference. Summer has been with the conference since it started and says it's come a long way.
This Growers' Own Conference became powerful in that way of giving us, one, some reassurance that we're all on the same path and giving us some encouragement, but also sharing knowledge. And today that is still the case. And we're working on a whole new group of young farmers that have both the knowledge and the desire to grow better food.
Topics at Growers' Own include conservation grants, cover crops, pest management, and more. The conference is sponsored by the Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides. This will be the 12th time the conference has taken place, and the theme is Back to Our Roots. Summer and other producers helped create the state's organic certification program in 1990, which the Idaho State Department of Agriculture still runs. He calls it a good program for farmers.
There's a growing influence of organic agriculture as a good option for smaller farms particularly, even though it's been co-opted by giant business retailing and distributing that still kind of works on marginalizing the small and medium-sized farmer.
Summer adds organic practices make their products tastier and more enticing for consumers.
People find that our food is better. It has more flavor. It's fresher. It stays longer. And some of the reasons that food is fresher is grown and sold in the area where people live. To me, the quality that we can produce sure speaks a lot to the validity of organic farming.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The University of Idaho announced last week it will partner with the University of Utah's Spencer Fox Eccles School of Medicine to create an undergraduate medical education program in southern Idaho. The university says the new program will complement the University of Idaho's Moscow-based undergraduate WAMI medical education program, which is a partnership with the University of Washington and prepares pre-med students for graduate medical studies based on the UW campus in Seattle. The new partnership is part of the University of Idaho's compliance with last year's House Bill 368, which requires the University of Idaho to increase the number of seats in a non-WAMI medical program located in the Mountain Time Zone by 10 seats per year for the next 3 years. The University of Idaho already has 10 seats in the University of Utah Medical Training Program, and the University of Utah is a likely candidate for the additional seats. Legislative leaders want to increase the number of physicians in Idaho, which is 50th in the nation in the number of physicians per capita. Last year, Idaho lawmakers complained WAMI, which is run out of the University of Washington in Seattle, was slow to respond to requests for additional Idaho seats and slow to sign a statement that no Idaho funds would be used to train doctors in how to do abortions, even though those might be medically necessary in an emergency. The University of Washington did sign a no Idaho funds for abortion statement in February, even though abortions are still legal in Idaho if the life of the pregnant woman is threatened by the pregnancy. Speaking about the new partnership with the University of Utah, UI President C. Scott Green wrote in a statement, "The University of Idaho is proud to lead this collaborative effort to grow Idaho's physician workforce. By working together, we can ensure medical education remains accessible and responsive to Idaho's communities, including rural and underserved areas." The Daily News reports under the agreement, the UI and the University of Utah will have equal representation on a joint steering committee for the Treasure Valley-based program. The steering committee will control admissions processes, curriculum development, student support, clinical training, faculty recruitment, and overall program governance. Students who join the program will be required to sign an agreement committing to at least 4 years of medical practice in Idaho after their residency or repaying the state of Idaho's investment in their undergraduate education. You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and Rembrandt Tree Care, family owned and operated since 1977. A conscientious approach to urban forestry with year-round tree service on the Palouse and surrounding areas. You can reach Rembrandt Tree Care at 509-330-0699.
KRFP thanks all of its donors and underwriters for helping make this programming possible.
People who came to Saturday's town hall on state health care funding at the 1912 Center highlighted something few know about, that many Idaho residents have moved to Washington because of the failures of Idaho's health care funding. Idaho's legislative Democrats have taken on the job of holding town hall meetings around the state to take input for the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee on planned budget cuts for the next fiscal year. Democrats on the powerful Budget Writing Committee have asked co-chairs Senator C. Scott Groh and Representative Josh Tanner, both of Eagle, to take public input on issues such as health care cuts, education funding cuts, and other department cuts, but they refused. On Saturday, Democratic Representatives Megan Egbert and Monica Church, both of Boise, hosted a meeting to take input on planned health care cuts at the 1912 Center in Moscow, attended by about 100 people. Idaho Association of Community Providers co-chair Laura Scurry spoke about how cuts to mental health programs, including the Assertive Community Treatment Program, which includes home visits for severely mentally ill people, are devastating and will cause the imminent death of people who go off their meds.
In the last few years, behavioral health has, specifically mental health, which is my specialty, has gone through a series of changes. Idaho invested tens of millions of dollars to implement the Idaho Behavioral Health Plan. In the last 8 months, we have undone dozens of millions of dollars of the money that we put in last year to undo it, which is just devastating because we were only about halfway through implementation. And that leads me to the managed care concept. Managed care, I prefer working under managed care. However, having gone through the last 6 months of chainsaw experiences, I have two deceased clients in my coalition. I have I'm expecting 2 to 3 more in the next 45 days. Dealing with the death in my agency is devastating. It's devastating to our state. And understanding that each human has died and each death is catastrophic to families, communities, it destabilizes. So you guys know all this.
That was Idaho Association of Community Providers co-chair Laura Scurry. Also at the meeting, Krista Kramer, who has helped people with developmental disabilities and other health problems navigate the healthcare system in Idaho, pointed to how numerous people end up moving to Washington in order to maintain healthcare.
Spent 25 years in this community working to keep people independent in their own homes. A lot of work on the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Fair Housing Act, and as Idaho was trying to expand Medicaid, there was 6 years, I believe, between the time that Washington adopted Medicaid expansion and the time that Idaho did. And during that period of time, I'm trying to think how many people I helped move to Pullman because there was no answer to how do I get health care for people under the poverty level who did not have, not yet have a disability determination from Social Security. And there's a difference between being disabled according to Social Security and having a disability that does interfere with your employment opportunities. That, you know, it might mean that you can work according to your schedule, but there are times when your schedule, your health, your body doesn't cooperate with your employer's schedule. Many people were working, but were working for small employers who were not required to provide health insurance. And then there is the 2-year waiting period between a disability determination and the time that someone actually qualifies for Medicare. So in that 2 years, there is this huge black hole. And it wasn't unusual for us to work with people who had no income and no health insurance. And that was before CHAZ existed and before there was this 6-year period where Idaho dug in their heels against Medicaid expansion, and that choice was available just 2 miles that direction. Anyway, so switching topics a little bit. Our first speaker mentioned a Texas lawsuit about home and community-based services. And I don't know how many, I don't know if you're aware, but on January 16th, a year ago, the Department of Justice found Idaho violates the Olmstead Act, the federal civil rights law that segregates people with physical disabilities into long-term care facilities. So most of the arguments or the findings by the Department of Justice related to our underfunding of the community care workers. So, and I see this repeatedly. A number of people that I've worked with, co-workers, leading advocates in our community have eventually fallen through the cracks, the support systems, the parents die, the whatever, and they end up literally being shipped out of state to Colfax or to Pullman because one reason or another, they're not getting adequate support. Their care workers aren't paid enough to be stable, and so they land somewhere. And last week I was in a care facility in Coeur d'Alene, and there was this hall of people who were under the age of 40, probably, many of them with developmental disabilities, some with significant physical disabilities that could and should be living in the community, but aren't because of the care worker shortage, because of the low funding levels.
That was Krista Kramer. Brian Rhodes spoke about previous cuts in Idaho health care implemented by a committee headed by Republican Senator John Vanderwoody of Nampa in 2025. Rhodes said since 2016, he has been diagnosed with 6 cancers.
Because of the cuts that were made 2 years ago by the Vanderwald Committee, my specialist urologist, which saved my life from my kidney cancers and my bladder cancers, and the genetic counselor trying to figure out what's going wrong with me, will no longer see me because dealing with Idaho Medicaid is so onerous for them that they just can't do the billing. So the only option I have to maintain access to my medical providers, which is obviously a very important situation for me, is to move from the state of Idaho. I can no longer be an Idaho resident if I wish to maintain access to my health care providers. There's going to be a whole lot more people in Idaho that are going to find themselves in situations like me, where their out-of-state specialists will no longer deal with them simply because the billing is so onerous. I don't know what the solution to this is, other than to actually have to move out of the state. That's how severe the situation is for some people. I've been very fortunate that they found all of my issues early enough that I'm staying here and able to come up and talk to you. But if I remain in Idaho, I risk not getting my checkups. And given my history, I have to be in a state that will cover my checkups and my continuing care. So I just wanted to let people know that the cuts that have already been made years ago are already driving people out of the state for the purposes of receiving medical care. Idaho has to do better. These are priority choices being made at the legislative level. These are not mandatory cuts that have to take place. There are very rich people like Vanderwald himself who are benefiting from tax cuts that would much better be spent on covering people's health care.
That was Brian Rhodes of Genesee speaking at the State Healthcare Funding Town Hall organized by legislative Democrats held at the 1912 Center Saturday. KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox assisted with this story. Republican Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston was the only District 6 legislator who showed up at Saturday's Moscow Chamber of Commerce Coffee with the Legislators event. McCann explained she switches off with her seatmate, Republican Brandon Mitchell of Moscow, attending a regular 4-H event, so Mitchell could not attend the Chamber of Commerce event on Saturday. McCann started by saying she is working with a group of legislators from both parties who are telling the co-chairs of the powerful Joint Finance Appropriations Committee that they cannot cut Medicaid for people with disabilities, and we need to bring back funding for peer support services under Health and Welfare's ACT program, which is the Assertive Community Treatment Program for severely mentally ill people. As we reported on Friday's Evening Report, medical contractor Rick Boyce, who oversees the Pocatello division of the Assertive Community Treatment Program, says elimination of the program could endanger people's lives and put patients at substantial risk of institutionalization, clinical regressions, increased hospitalization, injury, illness, and death. Here's Representative McCann speaking about the nearly across-the-board budget cuts that the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee approved Friday, followed by a question from former Democratic State Senator Louise Reglin about the possibility of rebuilding necessary programs once the legislature slashes their budgets.
My concern, they want to cut. The chairs of JFAC have said that there's a 2% across the board. They have already had 3%, so they're adding additional, and 5% ongoing, which is a huge, huge cut to our education budgets, transportation budgets. Someone talked about transportation, and we can talk about that. So I will open it up to questions and let you, Paul.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
What is the... Has anybody done any research if once those things are cut, if you choose to rebuild them, how long it would take? Because I understand it would take, even if you reinstated them next year, it would take 3 to 5 years to get them back up and running again. And to me, that's the really serious impact, because once gone, even if only for 1 year... Has any study been done?
Yes, thank you, Louise. We have talked about that, because that is exactly what happened with the dental for in Medicaid. And when they cut that, it and I wasn't there then, but when they cut it, and I think it was the 07-08 crisis, but I don't see that our crisis right now is like what happened in 07 and 08 and our economy was bad. I see this as self-inflicted, that we have the ability to rein things in if we would. And but you are absolutely right. And so we said, okay, if you're going to cut these programs, we don't want them cut, we want them paused. Because if we keep the legislation in place and we pause a funding mechanism, then we come back and we can just refund whatever was taken out of that. So with the ACT program, we are actually trying to move that into statute so that it can't be cut. It would be a statutory commitment from the state that we want that program for those most vulnerable people. So we're working on some of those things, and like I say, it is slow going, and not everybody agrees with me, but we are fighting for that, and I'm fighting step with step with on the other side of the aisle with my Democrat colleagues, because we, again, I don't believe this is a partisan issue, just as I don't believe education is a partisan issue, and I've told you guys this multiple times, that is our responsibility. We made some decisions in our Medicaid expansion funding, and we said, okay, we want work requirements or volunteer requirements. And I voted for that because I said, all right, if we're going to make some changes, and if you think there's people that are not working that are supposed to be working, then let's find that out and say, okay, why are you not working? Why don't you have, so there may be some of that. I'm not going to say there's rampant, but if there is, let's find it, let's fix it, and let's keep it in place, though, to protect those that need it.
That was Republican Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston, who is a member of the House Health and Welfare Committee. The Joint Finance Appropriations Committee's approval of the budget is not final for two reasons. One is because the House and Senate must still approve it, and the other is because JFAC now operates with a two-step budget process in which they first approve base budgets for all departments, and then later in the legislative session, they consider enhanced budgets for departments. Another topic that came up at the Coffee with the Legislators was enactment of House Bill 93, the Taxpayer Money for Private and Religious Schools Bill, which the legislature passed last year.
There's pushback from some of the Republican senators and some of the Republican representatives, along with our the Democrats across the aisle, to say that isn't how we want to do this, but right now that is the way they're doing it. And then if they want something to come back, it will have to go through the enhancement program. And the enhancement budgets then are saying, well, we want to put ACT back in, so that's $7 more million. We want to, so they have in the budget builder, they'll have their revenue numbers, and then they start plugging these numbers in and what those budgets would be on the base budget, and then they'll plug in what comes back in the enhancement to see if they can figure out a way to balance the budget. So when we are running bills, if it has a fiscal note to it, then that, and if that bill passes, that has to go into the budget builder to say, okay, Lori McCann had this bill, and it's going to cost the state $4 million, so we have to plug that hole or whatever. That's how that works.
That was Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston. We now bring you some of the sounds from Saturday's Rally for Sanity, which is put on by Indivisible Palouse every Saturday noon to 2 at Cougar Plaza in Pullman. We'll start with an organizer with Indivisible Palouse. About 75 people were at this week's rally, which corresponded to Valentine's Day on President's Day weekend.
In the evening, we're also having an Indivisible Palouse monthly meeting if people want to check that out on Monday evening. You can find all this information on our socials through Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, Substack.
My sign says Stop ICE for Good.
And what brings you out here?
Oh, I feel like, you know, we have to be out here. If we're not the ones supporting our neighbors and trying to promote peace and try to help out where we can, then, like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
It's important to show up when you can, if you have the ability to.
It's trying to remind the folks in the community that we're not alone and we need to keep fighting back so that we don't keep losing our rights. Only caring about your own rights is exactly how you end up losing them, which is what we keep seeing. They keep, you know, even though technically we should still have the rights to due process, we're seeing that basically no one does except for extremely rich people who, you know, aren't even being prosecuted at all despite ample evidence.
Glad to see the people out here, and I think everybody needs to stand up.
Yep.
And speak out and do the kind of thing that's going to save our democracy.
Yeah.
From total ruin. So it's the place to be right now.
That was my grandpa who was just speaking, okay. Who has lived in Pullman for the past 20 years, 20-something?
48 years?
Almost, no, 40, I think, close to
40. Wait, and how often do you come here, Grandpa?
I come down here every Saturday.
2 years old.
Is that 92? Wow.
Wow.
So you're in good shape. You take care of yourself.
Same to you. You'll be there.
You'll
get there.
Yeah.
Is this Radio Free Moscow?
Yes, it is.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You've heard of Radio Free Moscow?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah,
they do good work.
Yeah.
I like Moscow. It's a very progressive community considering the state they have to live in.
That's right. And you know, they are ground zero for Christian nationalist takeover.
Oh, yeah, I know that. So there's a real conflict of interest. But listen, you know, all of us have a role to play. And we can do it in a lot of different ways, but it's so important for this democracy that is vanishing before our very eyes. And so we not only need to demonstrate, I think we need to resist in every possible nonviolent way. And I I'm fearful that the time is coming when signs on the street won't be enough, and the civil disobedience will really be what we all have the courage to engage in, and maybe get arrested. This demonstration itself may be outlawed. In fact,
what, the right to exercise your First Amendment rights?
I don't know as it matters with this administration.
That was some of the people at Saturday's Rally for Sanity, which is put on by Indivisible Palouse every Saturday noon to 2 at Cougar Plaza in Pullman, starting with an organizer from Indivisible Palouse. KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox assisted with this story.
It's officially income tax season, and Oregonians have access to free expert assistance through the AARP Foundation Tax Aid Program through April 15th. The program offers tax preparation and filing services for anyone, with a focus on low and middle income older adults. Kathy Gettle has been a volunteer tax preparer with the program for 42 years. She says keeping up with new tax codes every year can be overwhelming for people on their own, and that the changes coming out of D.C. can make it especially complicated.
We go through training and we do many, many, many returns. So we're pretty fast. We also double check everything. So you get a very high quality return done, and it's all for free.
Gettle says last year, TaxAid volunteers helped more than 19,000 Oregonians file their tax returns, securing $16 million in refunds. She says taxpayers can choose in-person preparation, drop-off service, or get help online. People can look online at aarpfoundation.org/taxaid to book an appointment. Gettle says all of Oregon's roughly 500 TaxAid volunteers are IRS certified each year to stay on top of the latest tax code changes. This year, that includes a new senior bonus deduction of up to $6,000 for individuals 65 and older, or $12,000 for those filing jointly. She says the annual training requires hours of study, but in the end, it's worth it.
During the pre-work, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this, but you get back at it and you forget all about how much work it was and just enjoy who you're with and working with your team.
TaxAid is the country's largest free volunteer-based tax filing program. Last year, nationwide, over 28,000 volunteers helped people get more than $1.3 billion in refunds and tax credits. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Weather for the Moscow Pullman area, 90% chance of precipitation tonight. Rain before 7 p.m., then snow, low 27. Nighttime snow accumulation, less than half an inch possible. 40% chance of precipitation tomorrow, slight chance of snow before 7 a.m., then a chance of snow showers after 10 a.m., increasing clouds, high 39, new snow accumulation, less than half an inch possible. 60% chance of precipitation Tuesday night, chance of snow showers before 10 p.m., then snow likely mainly after 4 a.m., mostly cloudy, low 27, new snow accumulation, less than half an inch possible. On Wednesday, 80% chance of snow, high 34, new snow accumulation, less than half an inch possible. Currently, 32 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business or nonprofit supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. Flashpoints is up next. Music begins at 7:30 with Bext. doing Spotlight and Chia Pets on 9 to 11 tonight. Nardwar at 11. Stay tuned for more KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP Radio Free Moscow. Love's Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. For more information, visit loveskombucha.com.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Palouse Prairie Charter School, an EL Education accredited expeditionary learning model school serving Northern Idaho students in grades K through 8. PPCS is a free public charter school that combines hands-on learning, rigorous academics, outdoor adventure, and character development. PalouseProrieSchool.org.
KRFP has another bad karaoke night coming.
The worse you sing, the sooner the gong. Each gong raises more money for your community radio station, KRFP.
Science tells us all things must decay.
Make it bad.
Pay to sing a song. Pay double to stop a song.
Something hallelujah.
Friday, February 20th at Mikey Zero's at 8 p.m.
But matter is finite, so nothing goes away.
As an extra bonus, we'll have a celebrity impersonation contest starting off the night.
Can you do Donald Duck in a Bernie Sanders voice?
Can you do J.D. Vance in a Minnie Mouse voice?
Can you do a Marilyn Monroe with Goofy?
There's going to be a thing at Mikey's Euros, okay? It's a Friday, February 20th, 8 p.m. You pay $2, okay? Sing a song, and you get $5, and you can stop it.
Flashing down the street.
Come to the KRFP Bad Karaoke Fundraiser plus Celebrity Impersonation Contest.
Friday, February 20th at Mikey's Euros at 8 p.m.
KRFP Moscow is the best in the USA.
Yeah.